Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking astronomy to begin the show today and what you and I can see in the night sky in the next few weeks. My guest, Jim Lattice, in the studio with me, director of the University of Wisconsin Space Place and a faculty associate in astronomy at the UW-Madison. Been with us many times. Great to have him back. Are you interested in learning more about astronomy or questions maybe about telescopes even? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas at WPR.org, or you can post on our Ideas Network Facebook page and like us while you're there, as a matter of fact. Love to have you do that as well. Jim Lattice, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
Before we get going on talking about the stars, let's talk about the UW Space Place. For those who are not familiar with it, tell us about what goes on there.
Well, Space Place, UW Space Place, is the outreach and public education center of the UW-Madison Astronomy Department. We've been, many years now, we've been doing public programs and school programs and things at Space Place, which is at 2300 South Park Street.
And in Madison.
And so we have lots of events there. In fact, one coming up tonight, which I guess I'll mention since we're on the subject. But before I forget, you can find all of our events on our website, which is easy to remember. It's just spaceplace.org. At Space Place tonight, every month, on the second Tuesday of every month, we have a guest speaker of some sort. And the presentation tonight is a really interesting one. It's going to mix history and very current, very up-to-date science on the Milky Way galaxy. It's by Professor Bob Benjamin. And his title is 2 Years That Changed the Milky Way Galaxy, 1951 and 2018. And both important things happened in Wisconsin at both of those times. In 1951, in fact, at Yerkes Observatory, which we were just talking about, the first evidence that our galaxy is a spiral galaxy, that it has spiral structure like many of those other ones that we see, that was first discovered there. And then in 2018, the results from a spacecraft that has been effectively mapping, doing a 3D model, in effect, of the galaxy by measuring the distances to stars, a spacecraft called Gaia. Just this year is now beginning to produce its major data. And so Bob Benjamin is an expert on not only on the history, but also on this modern science that's coming up. So he's going to combine these two things about how our views of the Milky Way galaxy have been evolving over the past 60 years.
I've been to some events there, and it's really a lot of fun. And I took Emily, and we climbed up on the roof one night and looked at the stars through telescopes.
We do have a sky program. So the Bob Benjamin's talk is tonight at 7 p.m. And these things are all free and open to the public, by the way. On the third Friday of each month, we have a program about what's currently happening in the sky, kind of the things that we talk about on this show, except I can use visual aids and things like that. And then weather permitting, we set up, we have a rooftop observing deck, and we set up some telescopes on the roof, and we can go up and actually look at a lot of the things that we talk about. You know, about half the time or worse, it seems like it's cloudy and we can't do that. But when we can, we do.
Then it's a lot of fun. Believe me, I really enjoy it. Michael emailed. You mentioned Yerkes Observatory. He wonders if you had a comment on what the astronomy community might think about Yerkes Observatory, that's in Williams Bay, Wisconsin, closing, and what might be done to save it.
Right. Well, that's of great interest to many of us around here. It is a Wisconsin observatory, but it's run by the University of Chicago since it was built in about 1897 or 98, somewhere along in there. But in Williams Bay, it's been part of the community for years. The astronomers still live there. The staff live there in Williams Bay. They're Wisconsin residents. That observatory has been really important for our science here at UW-Madison. There have been collaborations over the years, the 20s, 30s, 40s, lots and lots of interaction between our astronomers and the University of Chicago astronomers because of that location there. So it's a real Wisconsin institution. And the University of Chicago has, I should say, it was built in the 1890s.
Yeah.
So it's become, as an observatory, it's effectively obsolete for research purposes. But a lot of us have been using it. I've been taking classes there on field trips and things for years now. It's a wonderful historical and educational site that we would like to see available for future generations. So the question is, how does the University of Chicago get out of the observatory business, at least there? I mean, they're still very much in astronomy. They're a powerful astronomy department, but they don't use that telescope, or those telescopes, I should say. So the question is, how do they back away from that and then
hand it over to who?
That's the issue. So I'm hopeful. There's a community organization in Williams Bay that is proposing to take over the observatory from the university and operate it as some kind of a museum and educational site. But they have to work that out with the university. It's not really clear how that's going to work. Yeah. So that's very much, we're all holding our breath and waiting to see what kinds of negotiations come about there. But we're really, at this point, really kind of interested onlookers, although I suppose they'll be accepting donations at some point.
Okay. Well, let's look at the sky. What planets are visible right now?
Sure. Well, this is a great summer for planets. You just walk out your door. In fact, even before the sun sets, if you look really carefully, you can find Venus in the sky. It's so bright. But once the sun sets, you look over into the western sky, and the brightest thing over there is Venus, unless the moon happens to be up. But these nights right now, the moon's practically new. Look out into the west, and you see Venus, and you look south, and the brightest thing that way is Jupiter. And just about as things are getting dark, about 9 or 9:30, you look over into the east, and you'll see Saturn over there. So we get three bright planets right off the bat. And then as the evening goes on, Venus will set over in the west. And just about the time that it's setting, Mars will rise over in the eastern part of the sky. So there's actually a little while in there. I'm not exactly sure what the hour is, when technically at least there are four bright planets in the evening sky, although two of them, when they're all four up there, two of them will be really low in the east and west. But then a little bit later, by about 11 p.m. or so, Mars, certainly by midnight, Mars will be up high enough to see Venus will have gone by there. So we've got basically three bright planets in the sky, though. At least three all evening, and occasionally four. So this is a really wonderful time if you've got a small telescope to get it out, because it's just so easy to those planets just jump out. They're all the brightest things in their areas of the sky. And Mars is just getting better. So Jupiter sort of peaked back in about May, and although it's still very easy to find. Then Saturn a few weeks ago in late June. And Mars, the opposition of Mars, when it's at its best, is coming up a little bit later this month. So we've got all these planets are going through peak observing periods just now this summer.
Oh, sounds wonderful. Lynn in Green Bay has something for us. Let's go there.
Hello. You were talking about Yerkes, and I was actually just there for the first time a couple of weeks ago. Oh, my God, what a beautiful facility.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, isn't it?
And I would just really hate to see that go by the wayside, but our tour guide did tell us that they were hoping to get some kind of a foundation going, and I suggested maybe you start having membership fees, you know, where people can become members of it. And I would think that Skynet has got to pay some kind of money to have their, you know, their telescopes there and their, you know, their whatever their internet sky viewing thing is. So I don't know. I don't know if Yerkes has any, you know, grandchildren or great-great-grandchildren that might be willing to throw in some money, but I just hope they can get the funding to keep that building going, because it would just truly be a real loss to Wisconsin.
Yeah,
well, I couldn't agree with you more, and it remains to be seen just what kind of organization they can work out. It really depends on, you know, what the University of Chicago wants to get out of it, and what level of involvement, if any, they're going to have, and what they're willing to, if they're going to sell the property, what they will sell it for, and that sort of thing. So all that's got to be worked out. I'm sure that as it goes forward, if it's called the Yerkes Future Foundation, is the Williams Bay organization there that's trying to put this together. And, you know, no doubt they'll be wanting to run public events and probably have memberships and things like that. As far as Skynet goes, there's not really very much of that. It's usually worked on kind of a collaborative basis. You let other people use your telescope when it's night at your site, but then you use other people's telescopes when it's night at their site. So that that often ends up being more of a cooperative kind of thing than anything. So it certainly doesn't make a lot of money. Even if you do collect some fees, it's not going to really run a place like that. So they need quite a bit. I mean, that's a big, it's many acres of land, and it's a big old observatory.
Probably valuable land, if nothing else.
Well, there's that too. I mean, how much of that land might they want to put to some other purposes, and how much keep with the, I'm not sure what they've got, 70 or 80 acres around there. It's a fair bit of lakefront land on Lake Geneva. So there are a lot of things, a lot of directions it could go, and we'll just, all we can do really is wait and see, because these negotiations will be taking place between the interested parties and the University of Chicago.
Ann, thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Ron in La Crosse next. Ron, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I heard on the news that that Webb Space Telescope has come across problems, and that they they don't know when they'll be able to be launched. And I just wonder if your guest has the latest information, the latest dope on just what the problems were that's delaying it.
No, I'm afraid I don't have any inside information on that. I mean, these things develop problems. It's the nature of the beast. When you're doing one of these things, that something like this, it's never been done before. This is an extremely complicated telescope that has to put itself into operation once it reaches its station, which is not in Earth orbit. It's way out away from the Earth, in orbit around the sun. So it's got to go right, or it doesn't go at all. And so I don't know the nature of the complications that have caused the latest delay. I think they're now talking about 2021 as a launch date instead of recently they were talking about next year. So, I'm afraid I can't really tell you what the specifics of the problems are. It could be anywhere along the line, from technical problems to scheduling.
That reminded me of the 60 Minutes show this last weekend. For some reason, they had a part of 60 Minutes dealt with the Voyager. Hmm. And it was really interesting. A little history, and they talked with one of the scientists who was a young guy, and they needed some thin foil before they took off. And he remembered that his wife had some aluminum foil, and he had to call his wife and say, "Where'd you get that aluminum foil?" And he went down to the grocery store and bought aluminum foil. And it was used somewhere in Voyager, and I don't remember how it was used. But he ran to the grocery store to get some aluminum foil.
Boy, those were the days.
Yeah, those were.
I don't think NASA would let anything from the grocery store through the door these days.
If you haven't seen that 20 minutes of 60 Minutes, I urge you to go online and look at that, and what. You know, what Voyager has accomplished and continues to accomplish.
Yeah, those are amazing. When something does go well, you get decades of scientific information from those things.
It is really a fascinating about 20 minutes of the 60 minutes. Jim in Camp Douglas, thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you. Say, I'd like to know how much food my wife will need for a 20-year stay on the moon. I'm looking for I want to buy a gift for a friend of mine, and a fundamental basic astronomy book that would describe the rotation of the planets, the four-season changes, just basic knowledge, general knowledge like that. If I could get that, that would be great.
Let's see, a basic astronomy book there are so many good basic astronomy books out there. We use them for textbooks, basically. Probably the way to go is to look for astronomy textbooks, and there are just dozens of them out there. I would look for Google for introductory astronomy textbook, and you'll find a lot of them. You can probably go down to a bookstore and ask them to check with to tell you some astronomical textbooks that they can order. Just anything that's used for intro astronomy classes at the college level would probably be just the kind of thing you're looking for. I think you can also, in fact, I'm sure you can also find, there's a very good astronomical textbook online. It's open source astronomical text that's quite good. The author is Andrew Fraknoi, F-R-A-K-N-O-I. I think I got that right. Andrew Fraknoi. And so you can, I think if you just Google for that, maybe we can look that up here. But you can find his textbook free and available online, and it's really good. He intends it for people who want to learn astronomy either on their own or in a classroom setting, and has a he updates it regularly, which is of course something that your paper books
can't do. But I would highly recommend Paul Kinzer's book.
That's a good point.
Stargazing Basics: Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy is the subtitle. I think Oxford University Press. He just published a second edition or a new edition of it that updated it. But Paul Kinzer, and it's Stargazing Basics: Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. And I love that book. It's really, really, I can understand it, so that makes it.
Yeah, and so that's a great one for stargazing in general, familiarity with the sky. I just checked, and Andy Fraknoi's book is on the Open Textbook Library. And if you just Google Andrew Fraknoi, F-R-A-K-N-O-I, you'll go right to it.
There you go, Jim. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer today. Dave Potratz, our engineer, here on the Ideas Network. We're getting an astronomy update today, talking summer stargazing, among other things, with our guest, Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place, faculty associate in the Department of Astronomy at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us. Again, you can call in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's turn to Kate in Fox Valley next. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is a great program, and I was just wondering about this question. I've been noticing that I've been watching the length of the days on my Weather Channel app and noticing that they seem to be the same length for really quite a long period of time after the summer equinox. I don't know if that happens in the winter also, but how does the Earth stay in sort of the same position for that long?
So you mean the summer solstice, I think.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. So by the length of the day, what you mean is the time between sunrise and sunset.
Correct.
The daylight time. Yeah. Right. So the sun reaches the solstice when it is at its maximum northern distance above the celestial equator, or in the winter, the opposite, it's the southern, that is for the northern hemisphere, the winter solstice is when it's its extreme southern position. And it sort of approaches, I'm trying to think if I can think of an analogy. If you think about the a curve that just touches a straight line, that we would call that the tangent point. So imagine a circle. Imagine a curve that's resting on a horizontal surface like a tabletop. The sun is sort of following this curve, and it approaches the equator very slowly, and then recedes from the surface really slowly because the sun's path is tangent to what's called the tropic either one of the tropics at that point. So it's not crossing the equator the way it is at the equinoxes, and that happens fast. It changes rapidly because it moves right across the solstice, but it approaches slowly and then recedes slowly from the tropics. And so that's why the day lengths don't change very rapidly at all right around the solstice. There's a little bit of geometry there that it would help if I could draw a sketch for you. But but that's really the reason. It's because the sun's path is tangent to a mathematician might say it's like an asymptote near the time of the solstices. It's approaching very slowly, just touches the just reaches the tropic and then recedes very slowly, and that's what determines the day lengths. So it happens very regularly because that's just the orbit of the Earth as the motion is the same every year, and the tip of the Earth's axis with respect to its orbital plane that causes the sun to swing north and south the way it does. And so it's very stable and repeatable because both of those things don't change very much at all. That is to say, the Earth's orbit and the inclination of the rotation to the plane of the orbit. So that's the stability we're talking about, and we get the same pattern every year.
And we get it winter and summer.
Right, we get more or less the inverse. In the winter that we had in the summer. Right, if you lived on the Earth's equator, then you'd get exact symmetry in both halves of the year. And then so what we get is this asymmetry, where you get these long days and short nights, or in the winter the long nights and short days. And that depends entirely on how far away from the equator you are. So we're about halfway from the equator to the pole at 43 degrees here in Wisconsin, in Madison anyway.
So it's interesting to me, spent a year at the University of the West Indies in Trinidad and Tobago, and it was...
What's the latitude there? Do you remember?
I do not remember the latitude.
Probably
but
around 20 degrees or something.
Yeah, it'd be about 20, but it seemed like when the sun went down, it was like turning off a light bulb.
I mean, it was
light, and then it was dark.
So the celestial equator, as you get closer and closer to the equator, the celestial equator is closer and closer to perpendicular to the horizon, and the sun's path isn't right along the equator, but the same thing sort of happens. The angles get closer and closer to 90 degrees as you get to the Earth's equator. So the sun goes down and comes up really fast.
And then it goes down. Kate, thanks. Appreciate that call. Wanda in Manitowish Waters will give you a chance now. Hi, Wanda.
Hi. Yes, I've kind of been a stargazer, not professional or nothing, but I look at the stars all the time. I just moved to Opaca, and I was checking out the Big Dipper, and I noticed something, and it's kind of got my curiosity. I've just started noticing this, a circle right under the Big Dipper, under the cup of the Big Dipper. I can almost see a full circle of stars, and it's almost like a perfect circle.
So can you tell me about what time you're looking at the sky when you're looking for this?
It's usually about, I want to say, between 8 and 9, somewhere around in there. By the time I get done with supper and dishes and I go out and sit on the deck and I look up in the stars. And yeah, and it's, I've never noticed it. I've always I always look for the Big Dipper, you know what I mean, and all the stars. And this is almost a complete circle. It's about the size of the cup of the Dipper. So it's pretty big, but if you will look, you can almost see it's really bright towards the bottom, and then the stars kind of fade as it goes around to the top. But it's almost a perfect circle. I'm just curious if anybody else has noticed that.
Well, that's a really tough question because you can draw lots of circles through stars in the sky. So unless I knew exactly what stars you were looking at, let's say you're looking north. It's about 10 p.m. So if you're looking north and it's about 10 p.m., then the Big Dipper is on the left, that is sort of west of due north, sort of in the northwest. And below it, if by below you mean towards the horizon, then there is what are between the Big Dipper and the horizon are the other stars of Ursa Major, the westernmost stars of Ursa Major. So those, I'm kind of looking at a chart here. I can sort of see drawing a circle through those through those stars that would be about the size that you're talking about. So that if you pick and choose your stars, you can get pretty much any shape you want. So if you're seeing a circle, you're probably looking at other stars in Ursa Major, which is the constellation that the Big Dipper is part of.
And they'd be quite a way. Wanda was talking about some are bright and some are dimmer as you go toward the top. That would that mean that they were further apart or from each other? They wouldn't be circling each other.
I presume she means a static, a static circle there. Does this circle? It doesn't include the bowl of the Big Dipper, does it? You said that it's outside the bowl. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. So again, looking, those are the, if we're talking about the same stars here, then we're talking about the stars that are kind of the head of the Great Bear. If you were to look at a constellation drawing of Ursa Major, of the Great Bear, you'd see an arc of stars that are the stars that kind of make the head and the front legs of the Great Bear in the constellation pictures. So I don't know of any name for that grouping of that particular grouping of stars. There are a few other things that are close to circles, but they're not particularly near the Big Dipper. But if you're looking directly overhead these days, or close to directly overhead, there is a constellation called Corona Borealis. And now that's, like I said, at about 10 p.m., that's going to be pretty pretty high overhead. And that constellation is almost a perfect semicircle. There's a few stars missing to make it a complete circle. But it is a wonderful little, well, pretty good-sized group of stars, probably, as you say, probably about the size of the bowl of the Big Dipper. So maybe you're looking there if you're looking high overhead at that point. But it's not below the Big Dipper these days. It's going to be above the Big Dipper. This is another case where Paul Kinzer's book might be a really good a resource for this kind of stuff, because he tries to teach you how to pick out these shapes.
Yeah, it's Stargazing Basics by Paul Kinzer. Wanda, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Gary and Stevens Point emailed, but by the way, you can join in too with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Gary and Stevens Point say he's been a member of two astronomy clubs in Wisconsin and wonders if the Space Place could provide links to the Wisconsin astronomy clubs. Not everybody, of course, can get to Madison, but
We could. I don't think we have such a listing, although there is a research page there that might have those connections on there. But there is a listing of the of all the astronomy clubs in Wisconsin at, I think it's the Astronomical League site. And there certainly are astronomy clubs scattered around the state from north to south and east to west, from Dodgeville to Milwaukee and
La Crosse area.
Yeah, La Crosse area and Green Bay. Yeah. So so maybe it's already there. I'll have to look. But I can also check real quick maybe here. Yeah. And we can find a listing we can direct you to that would be a more complete listing than we're likely to have.
Yeah. So, again, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments. I remember being in Tucson, Arizona one year for the Perseid meteor shower, sitting in a hot tub in the evening with some other folks and looking up at the sky. And Tucson's a great place to look at night because they have they're careful about their lights there. And so the Perseid meteor shower, of course, we can see it here as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's coming up. And for a change, by the way, just on the Astronomy League does maintain a list by state, and astroleague.org will get astroleague.org will get you there. The Perseids, we usually we always get them in the middle of August.
Yeah.
12th or 13th usually is when the peak comes along. I think 13th of August this year. And last year we had a very nice Perseids display because the moon was close to new. There's a lot of years when it almost doesn't pay you to go outside at all, because if it's a full moon or something like that,
you're not going to see
it. You hardly see any. But we get another new moon this year, just kind of by good luck, at about the time of the it's actually new just a few days before that. So we'll actually early in the evening have a thin crescent moon over in the west, but it'll go down. And then we'll have a dark sky the rest of the night. So if the weather cooperates, then we could have another really good Perseids show this year. So the key with meteor showers, as you said, lights are key. That's so Tucson is relatively good about that. Getting away from urban lighting is the best thing you can do to enhance your chances of seeing lots of meteors. So a site away from either urban, there's two kinds of light pollution. There's the light that shines in your eyes from actual nearby lights, and then there's kind of the general glow of an urban area. And you certainly want to avoid that direct, those direct lights. And then, but sometimes you can even find a good site, even in Madison, some of the parks and things like that are kind of dark. Of course, they don't like you to be there all night long. but the Madison Astronomical Society, speaking of clubs, will be having a Perseid meteor shower event, which I think is out at Donald Park. So if you check their website, which is madisonastro.org, you'll find information about that. So anyway, weather permitting, you just want to get out into a dark sky, and a lawn chair after a dark sky is the second probably most useful accessory.
Yeah.
just to be a little bit comfortable while you're watching for meteors. Let your eyes get adapted to the darkness. And
the other clubs around the state will be doing the same thing.
No doubt. Yeah, I don't know of any specifics, but no doubt they all have their recommendations for where to watch meteors.
Let's take another call. Gary in Clam Lake. It's your turn. Hey, hi, Gary.
Hey, thank you for this show. It's wonderful. Talking with my grandkids the other day, we're talking about how fast the Earth rotates, and of course it takes 24 hours to go around. And we looked it up, and it was 1,000 miles an hour.
At the equator,
At the equator, that's correct. And then they were talking, we talked, well, how long it takes a year to go around the sun. So, hey, we're doing 66,000 miles an hour around the sun, and this ball of ours is cruising right along there.
Yep. So it's moving right along. I was just scratching out some calculations here. Did you want to know exactly how fast it's going, or approximately? Let's see. So the Earth is about 93 million miles away from the sun, right? That's the radius of the orbit. So 93 million. And then we have to multiply that by 2 pi, mm-hmm, in order to get the... I just messed that up. We'd have to multiply by 2 pi in order to get the circumference. That would be the number of miles it goes around in one circuit, and then we would divide by the number of hours in a year. And I guess I'll leave that as homework for the moment. I don't think I can run my calculator right here while I'm doing this. But that would give us the number of miles per hour that it's going.
That's pretty cool. Gary, thanks so much for calling. I appreciate it. We're spinning pretty quick. Pretty quick. Oh, man. Well, let's see. Lewis in La Crosse.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I've been watching the crescent moon the last few days, as it's getting pretty close to a new moon.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw what I thought was a jet right to the right of it. It had a blue and a reddish color to it. It was pretty tiny, like a tiny star. And I was waiting for it to either, you know, get bigger or smaller, and it never changed and it never moved. And I've been watching it the last couple of mornings, and I didn't see anything next to it, much less this particular object that was sort of reddish and blue. It you know, when you look right at it, it's like, okay, that's got to be, you know, man-made of some sort, not a star. So I'm wondering, if it was a star, what made it look like that? And I didn't see it, you know, the night before or Sunday either.
Hmm.
And it was the crescent moon. You know, you can see the whole moon kind of shaded, and this would have been right to the right of the shaded part of the moon, rather than right on top of the crescent.
Well, that's a toughie, especially if it only appeared just that one time. I would have to guess it's something like an airplane contrail being illuminated by the rising sun. If you were looking at the moon, then before dawn, the sunlight will illuminate something like, say, a jet contrail. And those, if they're heading towards you or away from you, they seem to be stationary in the sky for the length of time that they'll persist up there. You don't see them move really at all. But I can't think of
anything
astronomical
else?
Object that would match the description that you're giving there. Those colors are particularly suspicious, but also that it's just there that one time. So that's a tough one.
Thanks, Lewis. Appreciate the call. Rita in Two Rivers, it's your turn. Hi, Rita. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you for your show. I encourage people to look up. I'm wondering what your take is on some of the apps available, like Skyview for phones, and I'll take your answer off the air.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are lots of them, and so
I have Star Tracker.
Yeah, there's a number that are free, and so you can just try those out and see if you like them. I mean, they all pretty much do the job. And so unless you have some real special purpose that you need it for, that pretty much any of them will do. The one that comes to mind is called Go Skywatch. That's a free one.
Star Tracker's free.
Yeah, a couple of them, Star Walk, and there's one I like to recommend for laptop and desktop computers called Stellarium, which is quite good, and it will run on just about any computer that you've got that you can download that from Stellarium, Stellarium.org. They also have a mobile app that runs on iOS and Android, although I think they charge a little bit for that one. But their desktop and laptop version is free. So I like to recommend Stellarium. I use it a lot. My personal favorite among the apps, like for mobile devices, is something called Sky Safari. And it does quite a good job as well. But I think there might be a free version. But they have a tiered structure there where you trade up, you know, to get a little more functionality. If you want to control your telescope with it, then it costs a little bit more. And if you want millions of stars in the star catalog, then they charge a little bit more. Although I don't know why you would. You can't see millions of stars. But at any rate, just try out a few of those. And they're all pretty good. They all pretty much do the job. The family, the Sky Safari family, and you can, if you look at them in the App Store, you can find out what the name of that company is, but I've forgotten what it is. They make several other really excellent things, including something called Satellite Safari, which I use a lot because it helps you identify satellites. When you see something moving across the sky and you wonder what that is, you can find out pretty quickly with Satellite Safari, and it's quite good. So,
really cool. Thank you, Rita. Appreciate your call. Jim in Menominee, your turn.
Okay, Larry, great show today. I did experience something with the crescent moon around the 4th of July when Menominee was shooting out their fireworks. I live about 5 miles due north of Menominee, and I was looking about the time that they would have had the fireworks going. At the crescent moon, and then I could see a bright object inside of the crescent moon. And I'm thinking, how can that be? You couldn't see a star if that was there.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I saw another one and another one, and it was 8 or 9.
Huh.
And then they started to move around, and I figured it out. They were drones.
Wow.
So our earlier caller might have had a drone out there.
Maybe, yeah. If it hovered stationary for a long time out there, yeah, maybe. I did hear that sometimes people are substituting drone shows for fireworks. Now they did that for the Olympics or something. They did a big show of drones with lights on them, and they fly in formation and do cool things. And so. Maybe that was so drones in front of the full moon. Well, you were in just the right place then, because everybody else saw them somewhere other than in front of the full moon or the crescent moon.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it. And Jeff emailed to say 4-H has a pretty strong astronomy project. La Crosse and Sauk counties have observatories, and any 4-H county agent can direct 4-Hers to this information. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
very cool as well. And here we are out of time. Boy, it's flown by. Tonight you've got an event, you said?
Right. 7 p.m. at Space Place. We have that talk about what's happening, the 1951 and 2018, 2 years that changed the Milky Way galaxy.
Always a pleasure, Jim. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place, a faculty associate in astronomy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Great to have him along. And, you know, we're going to look to the skies coming up next as well, only not so far away. We'll talk about some of the birds that are flying through the skies next with our guest, Bill Volkert. You stay with us.